Chapter 8 Elith ran her fingertips across the rough stone, studied the cliff face stretching some 50 feet high and washed orange golden in the morning light. From her long years of study, training, and experience, she should have been able to easily discern what was wrong with the cliff. But no matter where she looked, everything about it seemed right. The cracks, the erosion from wind and rain, the layering. Even to the touch, it seemed as natural as any terrain she'd encountered. The stone was ancient and granitic, with some sedimentary limestone and other trace minerals at home in the composition. It was well-formed, without flaw or defect, as if the land had always been this way, and they had suffered from some strange collective delusion. It would have been the most logical determination if not for the scattered pieces of a once mighty First House starship embedded within. The whole situation was a mystery and a marvel. Everywhere she looked, from the top of the cliff down into the basin where she stood, the environment possessed all the signs and hallmarks she would expect from long-weathered features of the terrain. The forest at the bottom appeared undisturbed by the sudden change of topography. A buffer of open ground ran 50 yards between the foot of the cliff and the tree line, and even that was unbroken and covered in the plant matter and scrub brush one would expect. But for all the awe the chimeric landscape induced, still nothing was so mind-bending as the state of the ship. Across the shallow bowl of the basin, parts and pieces of the First House vessel lay spread. Several components had already been excavated, but the majority remained strewn throughout the clearing, some fully exposed, most partially buried. The other task force members crawled over the site, which vibrated and whirred with the sounds of dozens of Oyun's drones. It struck Elith as a scene she had witnessed on many worlds, though at a larger scale, ants and flies swarming over a carcass. "What do you make of it?" Nieta asked from behind her. "I'm not sure," Elith answered. She looked up the face of the cliff again. "It's like 10,000 years of change happened in an instant."
"Not the land," Nieta said. "The ship."
Elith turned. Nieta stood with her back to the cliff, surveying the field before her. The heaviness in her voice revealed the intent of the question. Against hope, hoping for some explanation beyond the obvious. Elith stepped closer, drew up alongside her.
"I can't see how anyone could have survived," she said, "no matter how strongly I want to believe otherwise."
Nieta nodded slowly.
"It was the outcome I had expected," she replied, "but to see it confirmed is almost more than I can bear."
The two stood together in silence a span, before Nieta added,
"I've seen crash sites before, but never one this catastrophic."
"It wasn't a crash," Sardis said, approaching from Elith's left, a gunmetal panel in his hands.
Oyun trailed behind him, clearly trying to catch up before he missed more of the conversation.
"What?"
Nieta asked.
"It wasn't a crash," the envoy repeated, joining them.
He held the panel out for them to see. Elith recognized it as a section of a winglet from the craft.
"No sign of damage, no stress in the material. Our technicians couldn't have done a more pristine job if they'd simply removed this for repairs." "For the few parts we've located," Oyun countered as he arrived. "But we shouldn't assume that's true for the bulk of the craft."
"You're assuming there is a bulk of the craft," Sardis answered.
"We know there's an anomalous field around the planet," the Arbiter said, "dampening gravity, preventing it from propagating as it should, crossing the threshold at a high velocity or too steep an angle, or some other such variable, could have caused a gravitic shockwave, something like explosive decompression. A miscalculation in trajectory produced by the unusual gravitational threshold?"
"That would be a simple theory," Sardis said, clearly unconvinced.
Hypothesis, Oyun corrected, but one I'd prefer to disprove before making other wilder conjectures.
Advocate, Sardis said, addressing Nieta. Is there any First House operational protocol that would account for... He paused to wave his hand at the field.
This?
For what, exactly? Nieta said.
Oh, anything, really. Just off the top of my head, say, dramatic measures to obscure a landing site, for example.
Eleth recalled the envoy's briefing and his passing mention of the Hezra asset that had been sent along with the task force. She picked up the thread before Nieta could respond.
You think they destroyed the ship, Eleth said, to cover the theft of your device.
Sardis looked to her with an arched eyebrow and a fleeting glint of appreciation.
Dissembled is more like it, he said, holding up the panel.
That is a ridiculous, moronic accusation, Nieta said sharply, even coming from a Hezra stooge like yourself.
Perhaps, Sardis replied, but it is a hypothesis. The asset on loan to the Paragon's task force is of experimental nature, and I believe we can all agree that forthrightness has never been the First House's strongest trait.
I won't argue the Paragon's capacity for deception, Eleth said, but I can assure you, Envoy, if she'd wanted to steal a Hezra device, her design to do so would have been far more subtle.
And given the vast array of this planet's anomalous features, Oyun added, I believe our time is better spent focused on it without the distraction of imaginary betrayals.
Sardis regarded Eleth and then Nieta for several seconds each, his keen gaze searching for any sign of deceit.
The mere suggestion is disgusting, Nieta said, staring him down. If you had any honor at all, you would be ashamed for having voiced it, let alone having thought it.
Sardis grunted.
Shame requires ego, Advocate, and I am but a humble instrument of the Hezra Ka, he said, and I nevertheless would like to verify that it is still somewhere on this planet, even if it has been reduced to its individual components.
He started to turn to leave, but Eleth stopped him with a question. Just how experimental was it? He paused and glanced back at her.
Beyond your need to know, he said.
Enough to tear a ship apart? She continued. Or to cause the surface of a planet to change?
Also, beyond your need to know. In the hands of the First House, Oyun said, the potential outcomes...
Arbiter, the envoy said loudly, we have a great deal of work, and we've wasted enough time talking.
Sardis marched off immediately, but Oyun lingered a few moments, obviously debating whether or not to say more, despite the envoy's admonition. But he decided against it, offered a quick nod, and strode to catch up.
That man is intolerable, Nieta said, and I'm disappointed that you would attempt to ingratiate yourself to him by slandering the Paragon. Disappointed, but I suppose not surprised.
Eleth felt no need to respond. Her mind was elsewhere, working to incorporate the new information. Though Arbiter Oyun genuinely seemed concerned with the planet, Sardis's role had become more apparent. His primary objective was the recovery of whatever piece of Hezra technology had been lost. She wondered just how much of the task force would abandon the world once that objective had been achieved. Apart from a handful of troopers left behind to guard the camp and a few at the perimeter, all the members of that task force were pitching in with the recovery effort, regardless of rank or role. The cliff face was like an archaeological dig turned vertical. Eleth scanned the scene again with fresh eyes, to see if she could discern who among them might be solely concerned with locating the device, and whether, by their method of search, she could glean an idea of what they might be looking for. Their engagement with the task was complete and understandable. It was the first real concrete objective they'd had since they landed. but Elith couldn't escape the sense that everyone else had homed in so thoroughly on that task, in part because they were all eerily reluctant to look too closely at the geological phenomenon that had unearthed the remains of the vessel, as if, by considering it, they would have to accept it, and accepting it was something like madness. Oyun shuttled back and forth between workstations, sometimes examining extracted portions of the ship, sometimes poring over data coming in from the drone's evaluation of the emergent cliff. His was powerfully internal work. Elith noted how intensely focused he was, filtering out all the noise and threat of distraction around him as he processed all he was learning. Sardis, on the other hand, seemed the polar opposite, though to Elith's surprise, apparently no less effective. He ranged the entire site in near-constant, one-sided communication with the crew and staff in high orbit above them aboard the Clariana, coordinating both ground and space-based efforts simultaneously. Seeing the two of them in action together revealed to Elith the unquestionable supremacy of this Hezra task force in a way she'd not yet witnessed. Briefly, she wondered what the Ascendants might accomplish if not for the divide between her house and theirs. But then she recalled that the shifting planet beneath her feet might very well be the result of just such an interaction. As much as her heart longed to learn the fate of her sisters, she knew there was little she could do to speed that effort. So instead, she decided to confront that which the others seemed intent on ignoring, the land itself. "Where are you going?" Nieta challenged as Elith began to move. "Out there," she answered, nodding toward the tree line. Nieta shook her head, out of the question. "There's work to be done away from all this commotion," Elith said, "and I'm of no use here." "That will be even more true if you give the envoy reason to keep you chained." "Do you need to escort me?"
"No. I need to keep watch here, to see firsthand what they discover."
"Nieta, whatever they find won't be an answer. At best, it might point in a direction, but the answer lies out there somewhere. I know you feel it too." Nieta regarded her for a moment.
"I'll stay within sight of the perimeter," Elith added. Nieta returned her gaze to the Hezra troopers, scanning the site, apparently closing off the conversation. After a few seconds, though, she spoke.
"Don't leave the clearing."
It wasn't what Elith had wanted, but even the edge of the forest was likely to tell her more than she could learn from any further study of the cliff face.
"Yes, Advocate," she said,
offering a minimal bow. She turned and left the cliff, headed across the open ground. One of the troopers holding the perimeter reacted to her approach, but when he'd identified who she was, he gave her an expressionless nod and returned his attention once more to the woods. Elith read in that brief look, though, the gnawing, formless anxiety that she too was feeling. He was a hardened veteran, but he'd never faced a situation like this one. None of them had. The bizarre change in the terrain was here, in the basin at the foot of the cliff. But its source, she felt, was much farther away, and possibly much, much deeper. She could hear the call clearly, but for perhaps the first time in her life, she was hesitant to answer it. Elith could feel the trooper's eyes on her as she continued past him and crossed the 20-foot buffer of open ground between him and the tree line. She stopped within arm's length of a tree, reached out with a delicate touch. Its bark was silvery gray, papery and smooth in appearance, but textured beneath her fingertips as though coated by fine-grained sand. Branches stretched some 50 feet above, turned upward as if to paint the sky with its foliage, yellow-green and vibrant. All along the trunk, from root to the reach of Elith's gaze, fine cracks ran, etched like lines of laughter and sorrow in an aged and weathered face, or armor scarred through many battles. She stepped closer and crouched, running her fingers along the top of an exposed root down to where it slipped beneath the earth. Unbroken, undisturbed, with no sign of traumatic movement of the terrain. And yet, it wasn't quite right. Elith glanced up to the top of the tree again. Though she couldn't identify the species, the pattern of its branches suggested it had grown surrounded by other trees, not at the edge of a clearing. She looked down the length of the tree line. From that vantage, the transition from clearing to forest seemed too abrupt, as though the trees were a tide receded from its shore, or a veil drawn back. She stood and walked slowly along the border, letting her fingers slide along the trunk of each tree she passed. On any other world, their stories would be encoded in their roots and bark and leaves. Here, on Quell's Shadow, Elith was no longer certain she could trust those sources. Her mind was only just beginning to work through the implications when her assessment was interrupted by a call from behind her. When she looked, she saw several troopers gathered in a cluster on the far side of the clearing, and others headed toward them. Sardis crossed the basin with his long, purposeful stride. Oyun moved to the troopers at a trot. Whatever they'd found was significant enough to stop all other work. As Elith jogged over to join the group, a trooper left the cluster headed toward the utility skimmer parked near the cliff base. Korush stood with his machine guardian a few yards back from everyone else. He glanced at her as she approached and continued to watch her as she merged with the group. When she did, she understood the reaction. They'd uncovered a capsule, 8 feet long, with a slick, graphite-colored shell and slender, transparent window. Unmistakably a stasis module for keeping critically injured personnel stable until full medical treatment could be rendered. It appeared to be perfectly intact and operational. Her heart leaped with an unfocused hope that someone, anyone, had survived. "Who is it?" Elith asked. Sardis answered without turning to address her.
"It would appear we've located our asset," the envoy said. "The question of the immediate moment is whether or not it is still functional."
His answer simultaneously deflated her hope that they'd found a member of the house, and puzzled her as to why he called the asset it, if it was actually personnel. She glanced at Subo then, and wondered if there might be a creation even more advanced, even more dreadfully powerful, something not human, but nevertheless organic. The troopers struggled to load the module onto the skimmer until Subo moved silently over to assist. Elith couldn't get a clear view between all of the bodies and Subo's hulking frame. Once the module was secured, Sardis moved toward the skimmer's cockpit.
"Wrap up operations here," he said as he entered the vehicle. "Return to base and await further instructions."
The skimmer pulled away before anyone could reply, question, or argue. As the vehicle passed by, Elith finally caught a fleeting glimpse through the transparent canopy of the module. Her curiosity shattered in an instant. Though she saw the face only in profile, recognition struck her with the force of a thunderbolt. The Hezra asset was no device. No, the being in the capsule was none other than Varen Fetic. Chapter 9.
"Did you know?"
Elith demanded. Nieta was seated on her bed in their shared quarters, hands clasped in front of her, head bowed.
"Nieta, did you know that Eth Amuin was part of the Paragon's team?"
"It would be wise to calm yourself, exile." Elith ignored the mild challenge, and Nieta's response was answer enough.
"How long, Nieta? How long have you known?"
"You know it now," Nieta answered quietly, without raising her head. "When I learned of it, is of no consequence."
"No consequence?" "If you knew
before we deployed, and you withheld something that critical from me. How am I supposed to trust anything you say?
You can trust that I will tell you whatever I deem relevant for you to know.
Expecting anything more would suggest that I owe it to you, which I most assuredly do not.
If I had known earlier, it would have impacted everything I've done up until now.
Nyetta snapped to her feet, her face 3 inches from Elith's.
Exactly. And where would your focus have been then, exile?
She said, hard eyes burning with an intensity that her voice did not betray.
Had you known, what would you have spent your energy pursuing?
Elith's instinct was to deny the implication, but the question pricked her heart. Nyetta was right. Had Elith known, the thought of reuniting with Eth Amuin would only have distracted her from... No, she admitted, would have consumed any other cares she had. Until she had learned his fate, she would have thought of nothing else.
And you've made it clear that you still haven't learned your place, Nyetta continued.
Understand this. You are the lowest member of this team. You give no orders. You make no demands. You have no authority here, and you never will. As far as this team is concerned, you are nothing more than a tool. The sooner you accept that, the easier this will be for everyone. She held Elith's gaze until she was satisfied that the message had landed with its intended weight, and then sat back down on her bed.
We were brought here to deal with the planet, she added, not to restore old relationships.
The acid in the words made the double meaning clear, neither with Eth Amuin nor the house. The entire task force had been ordered to remain in their quarters ever since they'd returned to base. But the tiny space Elith shared with Nyetta felt too tight, too oppressive now. Elith turned and opened the door.
Where are you going?
Nyetta asked. Elith didn't respond. She had to get out, had to breathe fresh air under an open sky. She stepped out of the shelter, intending to run through her meditation sequence, but as she exited the structure, she saw a figure approaching. Karush. Behind her, Elith heard Nyetta stand and move to the entrance, undoubtedly to chastise her for her disobedience. She too stopped when she saw the Asirim.
Wari Karush, Nyetta called. What's the report?
Karush didn't answer immediately. He waited until he was within conversational distance to reply.
Advocate,
he said, by way of greeting, and then to Elith.
Aspirant,
in a tone that had just a hint of distaste for the word. Whether it was a reaction to her personally or merely to the deceptive title, she couldn't tell.
The envoy has requested that you join him in the medical facility.
Requested? Nyetta said. Karush didn't answer, just stood in place, looking at Elith.
All right,
Nyetta continued. Give me a moment to gather my things.
No, Karush said. Only her.
Elith didn't turn to look at Nyetta. But she didn't need to. She could feel her once sister's reaction.
Certainly,
Elith said with a bow.
Lead the way.
Karush nodded and headed back the way he'd come, without addressing Nyetta again. Elith followed, but after a few steps glanced quickly back at Nyetta, saw the confusion and disappointment on her face as she watched the two of them leave. Together, Karush and Elith crossed the grounds to the medical facility. Apart from guards stationed at the corners of the site, no other personnel were in the open. The Asirim didn't speak to her again, not even when they reached their destination. He ushered her into one of the isolation chambers and then followed in behind her and remained stationed by the door. The majority of the medical equipment had been shoved against the walls, hastily, from the look of it. In the center of the room lay the stasis module,
with Sardis on one side and Oyun on the other. Subo stood passive in the far corner, somehow unobtrusive despite its hulking frame. Elith glanced at the window in the module, and the sight of Eth Amuin lying within struck her with two barbed emotions. The disorienting dread of seeing a loved one laid in a coffin, its inevitable twin, the impossible but unavoidable hope that they would rise out of it and prove false the sorrow. In this case, she knew the hope was greater, that he really might come back to her. But she knew, too, that the greater hope might well be herald of a more devastating fall. She averted her eyes from his face. The churning of her emotions threatened the clear mind and physical control she knew she needed to maintain.
"Ah," Sardis said, "and now we are four. Welcome, exile."
"Envoy," Elith answered. She offered no bow to him, but when she greeted Oyun, she bowed with perfect etiquette.
"Arbiter?"
Sardis's thin smile showed he had not missed her subtle intent.
"Now, now," he said, "let's not seek offense where none was intended. It was for operational security purposes, not a personal slight."
It was no wonder why Sardis had not revealed the truth to her about the Hezra asset, but Elith wondered how many other members of the task force had known. Oyun, certainly. Karush, she guessed, though the man's demeanor was so uniformly flat, even if he had been more surprised than her, she wasn't sure she would have been able to tell.
"Why did you bring me in here?" she said.
"Straight to business."
"Excellent," the envoy replied.
"The Arbiter and I are of differing opinion on a matter, and so we are looking for a third voice to break through our impasse."
"On what point?" Sardis held out his hand toward the module, but said nothing.
"Obviously," she said. "Could you perhaps be more specific?"
"No,"
Sardis said. "We wouldn't want to contaminate your thoughts with ours."
Elith looked back and forth between the envoy and the Arbiter, trying to discern whatever she could from their faces. Sardis masked his emotions well, but the tightness at the corners of Oyun's mouth suggested the argument entailed some matter of risk. She took a deep breath to steel herself and then approached the stasis module.
"Do be careful not to touch it," Sardis said.
Elith scanned the module, evaluating its state. Like the other parts of the ship they'd recovered, there were no signs of damage, nothing to suggest a crash or an explosion or any other catastrophic failure. But the module itself was made of many parts and yet remained fully intact. Everything else they'd found thus far had been separated down to a component level. They'd hooked the module up to a base station. Its projected display showed an array of readouts, only a few of which Elith was familiar with. She forced herself to look through the window at Eth Amuin's face and upper torso. He was dressed in an unadorned Hezra uniform, of the kind usually worn by field support staff. It took effort and several seconds, but she passed through the visceral emotional reaction and evaluated him with a physician's eye, detached from the personal connection, focused only on the physical details she could observe. From what Elith could see, there were no injuries, no wounds, nothing to suggest any reason for such extreme medical measures. Ascendant's vessels of sufficient class were all equipped to provide extensive treatment, and advocates of the hand were of the highest skill in the healing arts. Whatever had happened to Eth Amuin must have been internal and devastating. Or, Elith looked to the display, searched out the basic vital signs. She wasn't trained enough to interpret all that she was seeing, but from what she could tell, his baselines were within reasonable ranges. "How long has he been in there?" she asked. Oyun bent forward to look at the display and then said,
3 months, 10 days, 17 hours, approximately.
And how long ago did the task force deploy?
Oh, about 3 months, 12 days, approximately.
So they put him in there soon after they arrived?
So it would seem, Sardis answered.
Or before,
Oyun added. Sardis gave him a quick look, and that gave Elith a hint at what the two had been arguing about. She pointed at the display.
Is this providing any details on his condition?
An excellent question, Sardis said. As far as we can tell, nothing's wrong with it.
With the module?
With the asset.
Oh, you mean nothing's wrong with him?
I prefer to think of it as property of the Hezra, as a precaution.
But why do you ask? Are you considering removing it from stasis?
Though she'd managed to stay analytical to that point, the envoy's question broke her detachment. If there was nothing wrong with Eth Amuin, then there was nothing to stop them from bringing him out of stasis. He could step out of his coffin, back into her life. Her heart leaped at the thought, but she checked herself before she spoke, wrestled her way back to a clinical evaluation. It was unlike the envoy to ask such a leading question, and the Paragon was nothing if not thorough in her calculations. She wouldn't have agreed to put Eth Amuin in the module without very good cause. Unless they could determine what that cause had been, it seemed unwise to go against the judgment of the Paragon of the First House. That line of thought triggered another, and Elith realized what the point of contention had been.
You don't need me here to make that assessment, she said.
You think he caused this? Sardis arched an eyebrow, apparently impressed, but he kept his voice neutral.
Oh, what suggests that I would think such a thing?
Your nature, she replied, and Oyun chuckled.
I imagine you're more familiar with his capabilities than you are with this planet's.
It'd be cleaner if he were the problem.
You would not agree, I take it?
No.
And why not?
Because none of this feels like his work.
Unconvincing, Sardis said. If he had sabotaged the task force in some way, then you think, what, they put him in here to contain him? Or he put himself in here, after the fact?
Either seems possible. Do you not find it odd that out of everything we've found, the only thing that has been left intact thus far just happened to have this inside?
Envoy, given everything we've experienced since we arrived, I'd say this is one of the least odd things we've seen. You have to consider it at least possible that something happened to him when they arrived, or even that they knew they were in trouble. And this was their way of trying to preserve him in hope of recovery.
Sardis sighed dramatically.
You disappoint me, Exile, he said, but I suppose I should have expected you to side with the Arbiter.
Which I would like to highlight she did without knowing what side I was on, Oyun said.
That's beside the point.
Very well, Arbiter. I will concede that it is not yet conclusive. But let the record show that I still consider the asset to be the most likely cause of the first expedition's misfortunes.
Yes, duly and repeatedly noted, the Arbiter answered.
And as I've said, there's a very simple way to gather evidence to support one view or the other.
Your proposal would require us to wake it, and if I'm correct, it seems like that could be a very bad idea indeed.
Less of one if we did it now, while we have Karush and our friend from the house here.
And if it is as I suspect, he asked,
then I will update my probabilities accordingly.
By how much?
I would say it makes your hypothesis more likely by 7%.
Sardis weighed their options, and though he clearly didn't like the idea, his bias toward brute efficiency seemed to win out.
Very well, he said. Bring it out.
Oyu nodded and moved to the module's base station,
where he began making adjustments on one of the control panels. Sardis took a single step back from the module, and without taking his eyes from it, he added,
"Karush, please be prepared."
Karush left his place by the door to stand next to the envoy.
"We'll bring him up gradually," the arbiter said. "If we see any instabilities, we can halt the process."
"How long?" Sardis asked.
"A half hour should be safe."
"And what are we looking for?" Elith asked. Sardis answered,
"Whether or not it has its voice."
Elith was uncomfortably familiar with the notion. She'd been captured by Hezra troopers before back on Quell. To keep her controlled, they'd affixed some sort of collar-like device that paralyzed her vocal cords any time she attempted to speak. But she'd seen no such device on Eth Amuin, and she wondered what method they may have used to constrain him. At that thought, she couldn't help but wonder what else he'd been forced to endure since last they'd seen each other. She felt her clinical detachment slipping, and despite her efforts, as they waited and watched, it came unmoored. What if he didn't wake? And what if he did? She'd imagined their reunion many times, even while believing it utterly impossible. But in Eth Amuin's presence, she had witnessed things that could not come to pass. Now, here on the cusp of impossibility invading reality once again, possible futures branched and stretched before her to infinity. Her thoughts and emotions spiraled in on themselves, forming a chain that somehow looped endlessly, gaining intensity with each cycle until her very being felt inseparably enmeshed within its fractal whirls. Each minute seemed to grow longer than the one that had come before.
"Stability is good," the arbiter said. "Here he comes."
Elith clasped her hands behind her back to hide their trembling. The canopy of the stasis module retracted. For a minute or two, Eth Amuin lay with his eyes closed, motionless except for the rising and falling of his chest, with breathing deep and even.
"Well," Sardis said.
Oyun just held up a hand as if to impart a measure of his own patience to the envoy. And then at last, the moment arrived. Eth Amuin's eyes opened, as though reluctant to do so. His unfocused gaze wandered a small patch of the ceiling above him, and then gradually expanded its range, gaining clarity with each moment. When he finally began to take in the faces around him, awareness and recognition came quickly. He saw Oyun first. The arbiter met him with a cautious but encouraging look, then Sardis, whose glare didn't change, then Karush. Elith could tell Eth Amuin knew these people, and well. It was not until his gaze fell on her that he showed any surprise. He rolled over onto his side to support himself on his elbow, eyes wide, mouth open, speechless.
"Hello, Eth Amuin," she said. It was all she could think to say.
"It doesn't answer to that name anymore," Sardis said, "nor at all, unless I permit it."
Eth Amuin still hadn't taken his eyes from hers, nor had he spoken. The envoy watched intently a few seconds longer before bending closer.
"Varen," he said, "I am certain I made clear to you the consequences you would face if I were forced to retrieve you. What do you have to say for yourself?"
Eth Amuin's eyes lingered on Elith a moment longer before he looked to Sardis. He opened his mouth to answer, but then shook his head and tapped his throat.
"There's no use pretending," Sardis said. "We already know you sabotaged the First House initiative."
To Elith's eye,
The look of shock on Eth Amuin's face was unquestionably genuine. He stared blankly at Sardis, and then looked to Oyun for confirmation. When he turned back to the envoy, Eth Amuin shook his head again, this time out of confusion.
"The entire force was lost," the envoy said. "All except you, of course."
"Mysteriously." Eth Amuin sank back slowly, lying once more on his back, eyes searching the ceiling above him.
"We are returning to the Hezra Ka this very moment, and when we arrive, you will face his judgment. If you have anything to say in your defense, now would be the time."
Elith hadn't thought of it before, but the medical facility lacked any particular signs of being a field hospital. It was unlikely Eth Amuin would be able to tell they weren't on a ship, and there was no reason to doubt Sardis's declaration. She wondered just what game the envoy was playing, but held still lest she be accused of aiding Eth Amuin in some way. Eth Amuin shook his head a third time, now in disbelief. He reached up and touched his throat again, but weakly, and then let his hand drop to his chest.
"Envoy," Oyun said.
Sardis didn't take his eyes off Eth Amuin.
"Sardis,"
the arbiter said, only slightly louder.
"Yes, fine,"
the envoy replied. He stepped forward and, with his fingers held in a peculiar pattern, reached down to touch Eth Amuin's throat.
"Sardis," he said, "envoy of the Hezra Ka."
He removed his hand and stepped back to his previous position. There was no obvious change or indication of what he'd just done, but the words and the touch apparently served to remove whatever restraint prevented Eth Amuin from speaking. He swallowed a few times, opened his mouth as if in a yawn, and then at last spoke.
"Arbiter Oyun,"
he said, and the sound of his voice sent an unexpected wave of emotion through Elith. Time, or mistreatment, had added a slightly ragged edge to his voice that hadn't been there before, but it took nothing away from the warmth of his tone.
"How much time until we reach our destination?"
Oyun glanced at Sardis before answering.
"Well, Varen, I suppose that depends on what you have to tell us."
Eth Amuin nodded slowly, but kept his eyes on the ceiling. His distress was apparent, but its source was not. He seemed trapped between the shock of the moment and the memory of whatever had happened before he'd been placed in stasis.
"I'm afraid there isn't very much to tell," he said. "We never even made it to the planet."
Chapter 10. "Exile," Sardis had said, "you are dismissed." That was how Elith's reunion with Eth Amuin had ended, and with it, any chance to learn what he knew about what had happened to the Paragon and her team. It had been over an hour since then, and still nothing. Sardis, Oyun, and Kurush hadn't yet emerged from the medical facility, and the rest of the site remained eerily quiet as the other task force members loitered in or just outside their quarters. She'd had no desire to return to face Nieta, knowing what questions would await her there. After having discovered that no one else seemed to care where she was, she had decided to take advantage of the temporary freedom and spent the better part of an hour lazily walking the perimeter of the camp. Now, she stood just outside the boundary, looking off to the tree line opposite the recently formed cliff. Elith's thoughts continued to churn, but they felt removed, or she felt numb toward them. They were adding nothing new or useful, and she allowed them to pass by without trying to follow where they might lead.
"Nice to get outside a bit," said a voice from behind her.
She glanced back to see Eth Amuin standing a few feet away, hands in his pockets, looking up at the sky. She hadn't heard him approach.
"Been a while," he added with a smile.
She turned to face him as he scanned the sky above and then the landscape behind her. Karush and Subo hovered a few yards behind him, like a pair of storm clouds threatening to descend upon them at any moment.
"Well,"
Eth Amuin said, at last letting his full attention rest solely on her. His smile broadened, and for a long moment they stood beholding each other's faces, neither seeming quite able to believe the other was truly there or knowing what to do about it. Elith had so many questions and so much to tell him, and it was all so complex and interconnected that there was nowhere to begin.
"Well," he said again, "here we are."
And somehow, that was the most proper thing he could have said, though it seemed impossible after all they'd been through together, and then, in their years apart, here they were.
"It's good to see you again, Eth Amuin," Elith said. He reacted at her use of the name, a sort of amused pleasure touched by an echo of sadness, like a grown man hearing a familial pet name from happy childhood years long past.
"I'm just Varen now, Elith." "I can't call you that."
"You'll have to," he said.
"They won't let me be anything else."
There was a tinge of sorrow to his words, a melancholy that seemed at odds with the man she'd known him to be on Quell.
"But I promise, whenever you say it, I'll hear something else instead," he added.
Her first reaction was that it seemed strange that he would allow anyone to dictate his own name to him. But at the thought, she recalled her own initial refusal to address him by his self-selected name, and how easily he'd accepted the nickname she'd forced upon him. She reinstated it.
"How about I call you Grief, then?" she said. "For old time's sake." "A compromise," he replied, bowing his head slightly. "Grief it is, for old time's sake."
He looked at her for a moment, bathing her in a warm kindness she hadn't felt in years. She'd almost forgotten what it was like to be known.
"You look well," he said. "I take it the house has treated you kindly?"
Elith exhaled a single, near-silent chuckle at the ridiculousness of the suggestion.
"I guess you didn't catch Sardis calling me exile?"
"Oh, no, I did," he said, smiling his mischief again, "and that struck me as a great kindness."
"Mind if I join you?"
"Why would I mind?"
"Yes, why would you?" he said.
"I'm quite charming, and I've heard to some tastes, possibly even handsome."
"And humble as ever," Elith said, turning back to look toward the forest.
Varen stepped up alongside her, about an arm's length distant. Neither of them seemed willing or able to face the intensity between them directly. Standing next to each other eased the pressure and felt more natural somehow.
"I just wasn't sure if you were out here doing your thing," he said. "Didn't want to interrupt."
"Yet you did. Which leads me to suspect you also, in fact, wanted to."
He chuckled. "I've missed you, Elith."
He said it casually, an effortless admission, but she felt the enormous weight of the words, the significance he bestowed upon them. It was true, but not in the common, light, shallow way. The words seemed to have risen unbidden from the deepest part of his soul, a mantra echoing from the loneliest moments of his isolation. Elith stood silent, unsure what response to offer. He didn't leave her much space to answer anyway, apparently expecting nothing from her.
"So," he said, "what are we up to out here?"
"The envoy give you permission to be talking to me?" she asked.
"Of course. I wouldn't have come out if he hadn't."
"I find that hard to believe."
"Well," he said,
and his words hitched a half-breath. He nodded to himself, not quite imperceptibly. Perhaps a tiny bit of the Hezra's feigned discipline found a way to rub off on me? If she had not known him so well, she might have bought the casual dismissal. "What did they do to you?" she asked, quietly. He glanced at her, gave her a sad smile and a half-shrug. "Nothing significant in the grand scheme of things," he answered. He held her look for a few seconds and then turned back to the woods. "But enough about me. What do you make of this place?" She lingered, watching his face, his eyes, but he kept both studiously turned toward the trees. That line of conversation was closed off to her, at least for now. "Fascinating," she said, likewise turning her attention back to the tree line. "From a distance, I don't much care for it up close." "Much like my sentiment towards snakes." "And spiders, as I recall."
"Indeed. Have you seen either since you arrived?"
"No, not a single one."
"Well then," he said, "it can't be all bad, can it?"
An image of the grotesque beast they'd encountered flashed through her mind, but Elith saw no good reason to inflict a description of it upon him. "I wouldn't jump to such conclusions just yet."
"Careful as ever in your judgment, I see."
"Force of habit," she said.
"Runs in the family," Farron replied.
Off of her look, he added,
"I didn't get to spend as much time among your former housemates as I would have liked, but it was enough to notice a few similarities."
"What were you doing with them in the first place, Grief?" Elith asked. "And what happened?"
"As I said, I'm afraid there isn't much to tell. Envoy Sardis delivered me to the vessel maybe an hour before we deployed. Once we were underway, the Paragon told me I would be briefed when we touched down on the planet's surface. We were preparing to enter low orbit when whatever happened, happened."
He paused, eyes narrowed as he replayed the memories.
"I just remember losing my balance, and one of my keepers catching hold of me. Dimini, I believe it was. A kind soul. She asked me if I was all right, and then I heard her call for help. Her face is the last thing I remember seeing until you woke me."
The mention of Dimini's name pricked Elith's heart, and Varen's simple description of her rang true. Elith knew him well enough to know he was telling the truth, and also to know he'd left something out. Something that still troubled him.
"The second to last thing you remember, you mean," she said.
He glanced at her, a scant smile curling the corner of his mouth.
"You can still read me that well, even after all this time? You're not as mysterious as you like to pretend."
He shook his head.
"It won't make sense."
"Very little does."
"It was, I don't know how to describe it, but it was like I was hearing the planet, but not with my ears. It was more internal than that."
"Like a voice?"
"No," he said. "More like a heartbeat. I don't know."
Varen studied the tops of the distant trees for a moment and then said,
"Or maybe it was just a really bad headache. At any rate, I feel fine now. I'm looking forward to getting to work. You know why they brought you here."
"I have my suspicions, but no one's been terribly specific," Elith said.
"I don't suppose you know."
"Actually, I do," Varen replied, turning back to her. "And sorry, that's my fault.
I told them I couldn't do this without you."
Elith recalled Nieta's earlier admission that they'd had help tracking her down. Though she didn't know what part Varen had played, there was no doubt that he'd been the key to the Hezra's successful search for and capture of her.
"Couldn't do what without me, exactly?" she asked.
Whatever it is we're going to do while we're here, he said, with a quick grin.
The brief flash of mischievous youth stole the years from his face, but the smile vanished as quickly as it had appeared, and he lowered his voice.
But you realize how much trouble we must be in if they're letting us be here together.
Elith nodded. I assume it's because of what we did on Quell. They obviously think this has something to do with it.
I suspect they aren't far wrong.
She studied his eyes. Does it have something to do with it?
He shook his head vaguely. I wish I could say for sure. This is nothing I expected to happen. But you know how I am about plans.
Someone told me they thought we might have created this world.
Varen swept a lingering gaze across the landscape. Oh, I don't think we can take credit for that, he said, distracted, wistful.
After a few moments, he returned his attention to her.
But wouldn't it be marvelous if we had?
He locked his gaze on hers, and she saw there a familiar glint, a tumbling mixture of excitement, concern, wonder, and impishness. It was a look that had once angered and appalled her, the sign of his reckless willingness to wield the power of the deep language impulsively. But in time, she discovered it also revealed his courage to stand in the midst of the unknown and the unknowable, and to embrace whatever may come. That part of him she'd learned to love, and there was no way to separate the two. He was both creator and curer of chaos, the solution to the very problems he himself caused, or at least had been up until now. Whether he could continue to be so remained to be seen. He paused again for a span, then said,
You do feel it, though, don't you?
I feel a lot of things, Grief. Be specific.
Well now, Elith, if I could describe it, I wouldn't need to feel it, would I?
He glanced at her sidelong. She returned the half-look, waiting, expectant.
I don't know, he said. You're the one in tune with everything. I was hoping you could help me define it.
She let him wrestle.
Fine, he said, relenting. On the surface, it's everything it should be. A new, pristine world. A wondrous gift of serendipity. But underneath, there's something in its call, in its voice. Something that's,
He held out a hand, waggled his fingers, grasping for a term.
Alien?
Elith finally finished for him.
Huh, he said, mildly taken aback. Huh. I was going to say pure potential, but I could see alien too, I guess, if you happen to be of the opinion that a planet should be only one thing instead of many possible things.
An invisible smile leaked into the words.
You're enjoying this. Enjoying it, he said. I wouldn't say enjoying, no. Some mix of intrigued and awed, maybe, with a healthy dose of terrified on occasion, if I let myself think about it too much. But don't tell Karush. I would hate for him to despise me for my weakness. He has so many other things to despise me for already. And I would be lying if I didn't admit there was something weirdly inviting to me about this place. Maybe not inviting. I don't know. I suppose this world might destroy us. Even so, I can't help but feel...
He trailed off, but Elith looked to him and saw it in his eyes.
Connected to it, she said. At home, Varen said, nodding. At peace. Like this is exactly where I am meant to be.
He looked again at her then.
You don't feel that way? He asked again.
Elith shook her head.
No, she answered. No, Grief, I don't. I don't feel anything like that at all.
He didn't seem surprised exactly, but subtly puzzled, perhaps.
Well, maybe you'll warm up to it. Or maybe I'll have to kill it.
It took him a moment longer to respond than was comfortable.
Maybe.
They stood quietly for a few long moments, surveying the silent forest together. Its trees were a wild cascade of variety and beauty, both familiar and strange in the familiarity. Like the cliff, there were no obvious signs of anything out of place. It took effort for Elith to recall that the loathsome creature that had ambushed them the day before was anything more than a disturbing dream. There was a slipperiness to the worst elements of the world, a shifting that made it difficult to grasp and retain.
"You've spent some time with Arbiter Oyun, then?" Varen asked, changing the subject.
Elith nodded.
"I got the impression that you're well acquainted with several members of our team."
"Certainly," Varen said. He glanced back at Karush. "We've been friends for quite some time."
The Arbiter mentioned that.
"He's a good man," Varen continued. "Good heart. Probably the smartest man in the Ascendants.
If anyone can figure out what's going on and what we should do about it, it's him."
"And until then?" Elith asked.
"I suppose we wait for him to tell us what to do."
He looked over at Karush again and raised his voice.
"What do you think, Karush? In the meantime, sleep late, go for walks, sit around and tell stories, that sort of thing?"
Karush remained impassive.
"Subo, how about you? Wrestle, maybe?"
"Do not address Subo," Karush said.
The statement was mild, the polite rebuke of a museum curator preventing a child from touching a prized artifact.
"I suppose not," Varen said. "I don't mean to offend you, Karush. It's just my great hope that one day you'll be able to enjoy something, even if for but a moment."
"My joy is to serve the way," Karush said,
in his grave but utterly courteous manner. And then, without changing his tone in the slightest, he added,
"But I confess that I do enjoy the moment when Sardis silences your voice."
Varen laughed aloud, a startling burst of mirth in that tensely near-sacred place.
"And all this time," he said, "here I've been thinking Subo was the funny one."
He leaned his head toward Elith, but kept his eyes on the Azurim.
"Karush is a patient soul," he said, "but I do hate to try him unnecessarily."
Karush held Varen's look, but made no response.
"Subo, on the other hand, loves a good story," Varen said, looking over at the massive machine. "I think deep down, in its heart, it's actually a poet."
Elith knew Varen well enough to know his purpose was neither mean-spirited nor solely for personal amusement. Based on her own experience, she guessed there was some work he was attempting to accomplish in the mind or heart of the Azurim. The unanswered question was whether Varen's true aim was for Karush's benefit or his own. Karush, for his part, remained unmoved and unreadable. The exchange struck an unexpectedly discordant note in Elith's spirit. She remembered well the effect Varen had had on the people who lived on his mountain on Quell, how effortlessly he could put others at ease, how he'd wielded gentle command over them. Certainly, she'd experienced it personally, fiercely, for herself. When they'd parted ways, she'd believed the two of them shared a connection as deep as the cosmos itself. But witnessing how expertly he could weave his casual influence, Elith felt a sudden prick of doubt as to whether or not their relationship held a truly unique place in his heart. She'd assumed that Sardis's control over Varen's speech was a protection against his use of the deep language. Now she wondered if it was merely meant to prevent him from gaining allies.
"Anyway, I suppose we should be getting back," Varen said. "Sardis was irritated enough as it was when he saw you out here."
"Ah," Elith said, "he sent you to get me,
in a manner of speaking."
"He sent Karush to get me,"
And you tagged along? I simply made the case that it would be difficult for Karush to retrieve you and keep an eye on me. I don't think we're in any particular rush, but I also would prefer not to give the envoy any reason to think he needs to lock me up again.
Elith nodded.
I suppose I wasn't going to get a chance to enjoy any more silence after you showed up anyway.
Varen chuckled softly.
It's interesting what we humans consider silence, he said.
He closed his eyes, tilted his head back slightly.
Listen, the wind in the trees and through the grass, and just at the edge of hearing, the sound of water tumbling. We call it quiet, but there's a music in nature, if we would but attend to it.
He listened a moment longer, then added,
But you already know that. Far better than most.
He opened his eyes again, gave her a quick smile, and then turned back toward the camp.
Thank you for your patience, Karush. You are ever the gentleman.
Elith turned to join him, and as she did, a spit spark of color flashed in her periphery. She reflexively looked to identify it, and was startled to find a small songbird, no larger than her palm, perched on the corner of one of the camp's structures. Varen reacted to her movement, followed her gaze.
Well, there's a fine fellow, he said. I wonder how long he's been sitting there.
Elith saw the bird in profile, and from that angle it appeared to be mostly black, apart from a few subtle scarlet markings at the tail and around the eyes. Neither sound nor motion of flight had accompanied its sudden appearance, and Elith's first thought was that the chromatic display that had drawn her eye had been the delicate creature materializing from nothing. But after a few moments of her watching, it flared its wings, stretching them in the sun, and she saw the burst of color there again. What had seemed black was in fact an iridescent midnight blue, and beneath its dark wings it was brilliant yellow, with greens and scarlet at the wingtips. The feathers of its sunshine belly rippled with dark, crescent accents that gave it an appearance like the scales of a fish. She guessed it was a finch of some sort, though the color pattern was one she'd not seen before. It was the most natural thing in the world, a bird perched in the warm sun. It took a moment for Elith to recognize the significance of the little songbird. It was the first wildlife she'd seen in that place, apart from the lone horror of the day before.
And do you have any friends about? Varen asked the bird, glancing around.
It occurred to Elith then that maybe the reason there'd been no life in the wood before had been due to another different dramatic change to the land before their arrival. Captain Ames had said something along those lines when they'd first landed, though at the time she hadn't fully grasped the genuine possibility in what he'd said, the full truth now settled on her. She was just about to turn to find the captain when the bird let loose its song. It trilled a long tune, some 15 distinctive notes or so by her quick estimate, in clear, pretty tones, with a hint of rounding like that of hollow chimes. The sound was familiar enough and pleasant, but like the bird's coloring, the song itself was one she'd not heard before. She waited a few moments more, and it repeated the call.
What a delightful little tune, Varen said, and he hummed it back to the bird, innocently.
A lilting, soothing melody. And when Elith heard it repeated, she realized she'd been mistaken. It was true she'd never heard the song from a bird before, but with a human voice behind it, she recognized it now for what it was.
Umari's song.
She gasped at the realization, grabbed Varen's arm. The songbird fled at the sudden motion.
What is it?
Varen asked, alarmed by her reaction.
Elith?
But she was already jogging back into the camp. She found Oyun and Sardis huddled together near Oyun's central field lab, talking with Captain Ames.
Sardis looked up at her approach. He saw in an instant that she had something to tell them, but he sharply gestured for her to wait anyway. He was mid-sentence. Elith quenched the urge to interrupt, but only barely.
"Because I believe it's a mistake to try to solve all the problems at once, Arbiter. Focus on one, and perhaps its solution will lead to others."
"Your work might be nearly complete," Oyun countered, "but mine has hardly begun. I won't sacrifice the time."
"This will require further discussion," Sardis said, "and clearly our associate has something urgent she wishes to share."
"They landed safely," she said. "They were here." Both men looked at her then. Oyun open and receptive, Sardis skeptical but listening.
"Explain," the envoy said.
Elith told them of the bird and its song.
"You're certain of this?" Sardis asked. "It was the same song, not just like?"
"Identical," Elith answered. "No question."
"And what's your hypothesis, dear?" Oyun asked.
"I don't have much of one, but my guess is the land changed after they touched down, swallowed the ship, and I think we're extremely lucky that whatever opened this chasm up stopped when it did."
"Indeed. Not much of a hypothesis at all," Sardis said in response. "But very well. Where did you see this bird?"
Elith indicated the direction and saw Varen standing some distance away, his back to them, with Kurush and Subo halfway between the two groups. Sardis immediately began walking that way. Elith followed.
"Captain Ames," Sardis said. "Join me, please."
It was the first time Elith could remember hearing the word please come out of the man's mouth. Kurush fell into step behind Sardis as they approached Varen.
"Our friend here," Sardis said when they were gathered, indicating Elith, "has a concern about a bird."
Elith quickly described what she'd discovered.
"Little fella?" Ames asked. "About that big?"
He held out a cupped hand, motioned with the other a rough size.
"Sounds right,"
Elith said. Ames nodded.
"Yeah, I've seen a few of them flitting around, mostly out that way," he said, pointing toward the trees where Elith and Varen had been. "First noticed it an hour or so ago, I'd guess. I wouldn't have known there was anything off about its song, though."
"Very good," Sardis said. "Let's see if we can find one."
"For what?" Ames asked.
"Between Oyun, Varen, and our friends from the house, I should hope at least one of them can think of a way to make use of it.
We certainly won't know if we don't try. Kurush, is it too much to hope that your machine could help in this endeavor, or is it only made to destroy?"
"Subo is made to protect, envoy. Its options are many."
"Excellent. Fan out. Call Subo when you spot one."
Sardis walked toward the tree line then, without further direction. The others glanced around at one another.
"Can't Subo track one for us?" Varen asked. "Save us the trouble?"
"They're quick, and don't like a lot of activity," Ames said. "By the time we got there, they'd probably be gone. But they don't seem all that shy.
If you don't make too much of a ruckus, one will probably come to you, especially if we're in the woods. Just don't go far."
Kurush and Elith both nodded.
"And I have to go too?" Varen asked.
"Faster we find one, faster we come back," Ames said.
Varen mimed, weighing the choice, but Elith knew it was just for effect. To her, he actually seemed eager to get into the woods. The small group branched out as they crossed the clearing and filtered in among the trees, walking softly and watching the branches above. Elith had gone 20 yards or so when the knocking sounds started up again. Close and loud. The floor of the forest seemed to vibrate beneath her feet with each knock, but she couldn't tell if that was actually the ground or if it was herself. She stopped moving, crouched, and placed her hand on the earth, closed her eyes.
"If another one of those creatures shows up," Sardis said,
I'm going to be displeased. His words were clear through the communicator, but she could hear tones of his natural voice as well, some distance ahead and to her right.
If another one of those creatures shows up, Ames replied, I'm going to be running.
Elith directed her focus down, through her palm, as she slowly compressed the leaves and fallen pine needles until she felt firmly the soil beneath. And with each subsequent knock, she felt the thrum, like the tolling of an enormous stone bell.
I've found one of your birds, Sardis said, and in quite a picturesque scene, no less. Karush, if you'd be so kind as to direct your machine this way.
He didn't finish the sentence, though it wasn't clear if he'd intended to say more. Nonetheless, Elith heard him make a sound in his throat, like a quiet gag or hiccup, a reflexive reaction like someone who'd nearly inhaled a bug. It was immediately followed by a louder noise in the environment, the soft, wet splutch of an overripe melon hitting hard ground.
Envoy?
Ames said. He waited a few moments for a response, and then, when he got no answer,
Hey, Sardis!
Elith opened her eyes, looked in the direction she'd heard the envoy before. She couldn't see him from where she was, so she stood and started walking that way.
I hope nothing fell on him,
Varen said. Elith was the first to reach what she guessed had been the envoy's position. It was indeed a picturesque little glade, no more than 10 yards at its widest, with a stream flowing along one side. The trees stood tall around it, and most were wrapped in the blossoming vines of tendril rose that they'd seen before. There were no songbirds in the branches, however, and Sardis was nowhere to be found. She heard someone approaching through the woods behind her, Ames, by the careful sound of his footfalls, but she continued to scan the area to see if she could pick out which direction the envoy had gone. On the opposite side of the glade, on the ground, near the tree line, 4 small mounds caught her attention, of unequal size but arranged in a line too straight to be natural. She moved closer to examine them. And when she at last realized what she was looking at, the cold shock of abject horror stole her breath.
What is that?
Ames said in a low voice from behind her. Elith fought through the sudden desiccation of her mouth and clenching of her throat before she answered,
I think it's the envoy.